You're listening to the Big Three of B2B Leadership Podcast with Mike Faherty, where world-class business leaders share their secrets for personal, organizational, and market growth. Gain powerful insights from industry leaders that have been tested by the fire.
Well, welcome everyone to the Big Three of B2B Leadership. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Troy Elmore. Troy is the CEO and owner of Sandler Training Houston. He's owned the business for about the last 17 or so years. And Troy has an amazing reputation of helping sales teams reach quota and enabling sales professionals to really grow in their profession and their career through developing their skills and learning the process better and just navigating what is oftentimes a really challenging environment of professional B2B selling. And so I'm really excited to get into this conversation with Troy. Those of you who know me know I'm a student of the sales game and really love this topic. So welcome, Troy. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, Mike, I appreciate you having me on. It's definitely it's great to be with you. It's great to talk about the subject. I could talk about this for hours. So thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, I promise you I wouldn't take hours of your time. So right. We'll get into the meat of it here. So, Troy, as I mentioned before, I really love starting the conversation with the entrepreneur journey. My favorite people in the world are business owners and business founders. And so I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your journey. I did a little research. You have a mechanical engineering degree from Texas A&M, great school. Yeah. And so naturally, mechanical engineer would lead right into sales training. So So I'm interested in that leap right there. So why don't you take me through that a little bit?
All right. So I need to give you some background on how I have a mechanical engineering degree first. And then that'll probably clear up some of this. And then I'll give you a little bit of how I wound up getting into this. So in 1988, when I went to Texas A&M, which, man, it feels like yesterday, but a few years ago, I grew up and my parents are both still alive. And I remember thinking about what I wanted to major in. And my father and I were having a conversation. And there wasn't too much of guidance counselors that I remember back then. And, I remember talking to my dad and he said, hey, look, there's about five professions that you probably could do, you know, in college. You know, it was like banker, lawyer, doctor, accountant, engineer. That's the ones he knew, right? He grew up, he worked in a plant. He was an operator. And I thought, man, I don't like any of those jobs. Man, I guess, well, I'm pretty good at math. I'll just do engineering, right? And he was like, okay, well, he really wanted me to be an engineer because he grew up around engineers and he always thought they were pretty well respected. And so I was like, okay, I'll do engineering. And that's how I got into engineering. And about 3 or 4 years into the degree at A&M, I discovered this thing called industrial distribution, which is the form of technical sales. I still have a technical brain. I still love to rebuild things. I love to think about things technically, which, by the way, sales is very technical. It's very structured and processed, and you can build it just like you can build, like I'm rebuilding a Jeep right now. You can do the same thing with that. So back to that story, I called him and I said, look, I know I'm 75% of the way through. I really was thinking about changing my major to ID, industrial distribution, so I could have kind of a sales / technical degree. And he said, hey, that's no problem. Change it. I got no problem with that. If you do, you're going to finish paying for your education. And I said, whoa. And so he said, just get the engineering degree and you can do whatever you want to do. And so that's how I got the engineering degree. But I already knew that I wanted to go into sales. I was co-oping with a company at that time. I saw the salespeople. And of course, they played a lot of golf and ate out a lot. So I thought, I want that world. I had no idea that it was much more than that. But I just knew I wasn't going to sit behind a desk. So that's kind of how I made the leap, coming straight out of school. Took a little bit of a job for about 6 months, starting to get a sales job, but then going into a sales role roughly in about 1994-ish, somewhere on there, late 1993. I can't even remember. I know I graduated in 93, but I don't think I actually took the actual sales job with a company at that time was called BWIP or Borg Warner until like May of 94-ish. So
okay,
you want to keep going? I can get into sales.
So you find yourself in a sales career, obviously, yeah. And then you decide, maybe I want to teach people how to do this. So tell me about that transition.
All right. So roughly I was in a sales career for about roughly about 10 years. And so I was selling to the petrochemical industry in Houston. There's plenty of it. And so I was in and out of refineries and chemical plants for years with a company that later to become Flowserve, pretty big, large company in the world. It's a conglomerate of a lot of smaller companies. And so I worked for them for years. And then I kind of made a little bit of a stint out of technical sales into software sales. I was getting an MBA at U of H. Not because I thought that I would really want to ramp the corporate ladder, but because I just love business too, and I thought it was cool. So I went and got an MBA, didn't have any kids. I was kind of bored. My wife, I got a degree, and you know, the company was paying for it. So I went and got it, and I found out about a company called BMC Software. And so I went to work in software sales, mostly because people said, you can't do it. Oh, there's no way you can go from, you know, working in this world to this world. So I said, well, sure I can. That's sort of an Achilles heel when I was younger, telling me I couldn't do something. And then I've gotten better at that now. I don't fall for it as much. And so I went and worked for BMC, which is a great company, great company. I traveled a lot. I didn't like all the travel I was doing. I didn't really especially enjoy selling some of the stuff that I was selling, but it was such a wonderful company. But there, they taught us this thing called Sandler training, the Sandler sales. I mean, what I own is a franchise of a 300 office, you know, we have 300 offices in the world, and they taught us Sandler, and I thought it was like God's gift to sales back then. I was 27, I knew it all. I had had so much luck where I came from, and I was so, but what I figured out was I was really good where I came from because I worked harder than everybody else, not because I was a good salesperson. I mean, if you work harder, you inherently can be successful in sales, but you will burn out. And so I realized pretty quickly after this guy came in, started training us on Sandler. This guy came in, this is a really good story. He comes in, his name is Ganesha. He's got a turban on, which is fine, right? But you know, he's got a wrinkled shirt. He's about my size. He's got a ZZ Top beard. You know, and I'm like, this is the sales trainer? Oh my gosh. And he comes in and he starts making jokes and cracking stuff and saying, his exact words to us. I bet you guys never thought that you would be trained by the Ayatollah. And so of course everybody was like, whoa, did he just say that out loud? But he was awesome. And 2 hours into this initial training into Sandler, I went, I suck so bad at sales. Oh my gosh, I'm horrible. I had no idea. And so it changed my life dramatically. So what I'll give BMC is that they brought me something that I never would have found before, because when I was where I was before, they just thought that the product sold itself. They didn't give you training for it. They just said, look, go out. My first initial sales call at Flowserve was go look for a smokestack and ask for a guy named Bubba. That's literally what you were supposed to do. And so BMC changed my life in that regard. But I didn't really want to travel. I didn't really want to work there forever. So I decided to kind of go back into technical sales. I knew I did not want to work for a large company. I knew I wanted to do something on my own. I knew I had something bigger and better to the world. I just couldn't figure out what it was. And that I kind of happenstance in 2003, I had a partner back then. He and I were both trying to buy a business together. And I happenstance back across the Sandler website, not because I was looking to buy a business, because we were looking to open like a manufacturing business of some sort. We didn't know. And it said opportunities available, and it just tiny little box. And I clicked on it and I went, huh, I could actually have a business coaching and training salespeople of the system that I love. This is cool. And so I called them, or we called them, his name's Brad. He and I called 2003, September. We went and visited him up in Baltimore, and 3 months later, quit the job and started this. It was just that quick. When you find it, it was just that quick. We knew it was the right thing. And to give you some perspective, I quit a job that was roughly paying me close to $200,000 a year. I had no kids. I mean, it's not a ton of money if you have six or seven kids, right? But at the time back then, it was a nice amount of money. My wife also quit her job because she'd gotten pregnant. And so we were both jobless and, you know, starting this thing up in 2003. So then that's how we got started. There's a lot more to the journey than just starting up and going, okay, yeah, happily ever after. But that's kind of how I got into the whole thing. And so mechanical engineering was roughly because I was good at math. That was amazing. Yeah. And, you know.
Well, you're probably not the only person who has a similar experience that I'm good at math, so maybe that's where I should go. And mm-hmm. and uh, it's um, You know, we all know that you know, college is an opportunity for us to discover ourselves in large part. And so it's a great opportunity to be exposed to a lot of different things. And luckily you got exposed to just the right things to kind of set you on a path that worked for you. I'm terrible at math. And so no one ever suggested that I visit the engineering department, but
you make a good point though, right? You just made a huge point. I think that's really important. If anybody is, you know, if you're watching or listening to this, you never know what's going to happen in your life. I mean, if you think about all the things that have happened in my life, from, you know, getting an engineering degree to going and working at one company and going and working in, I wouldn't have got the job at BMC had it not been for my wife. She's the one that suggested I go do my GMAT and do my MBA at the time that I did it. Cause I said, well, I think I'm going to wait a year. And she said, what are you waiting a year for? Just go do it. And so that U of H is who introduced me to BMC, which is who introduced me to Sandler. Now I got introduced to my wife from a blind date from a couple who's no longer even married and divorced. So I mean, who was a roommate of mine from college. I mean, the whole happenstance of life is when you really sit and think about it, you can ponder and reflect on a lot and how you got to where you are today.
No, absolutely. There's I've had some discussions. It's an interesting sort of philosophical discussion around saying yes and saying no. I mean, you can hear, you know, you can read a lot of books on entrepreneurship and business leadership that say, you know, the key to success is, you know, saying no, right? Is staying mm-hmm. focused on the core mission. And you know, I can sit here for the next 2 hours and support that argument all day long.
Right.
However, I think there is something serendipitous to saying yes sometimes when you're not necessarily prepared. And when you see something and your gut says it might be worth pursuing, it might be interesting, it might be stimulating in some way, and you don't really, it doesn't really line up logically, but sometimes just saying yes to things creates these sort of really wonderful moments in our lives that lead down really interesting paths. So,
well, I mean,
I couldn't agree more.
To that point, I said yes to going to do software sales, mostly because I thought it was kind of glamorous at the time. But I quickly realized when I got there that this wasn't my calling. It just wasn't my calling. And I was a little bit irritated at myself for how did I put myself into a position that really wasn't my calling. And I was like, how did I make that decision? And why was I so, you know, how did I not analyze that a little bit more? How did I do that? But you know, if I had not made that decision, then I wouldn't be here. And so at that time, I thought it was kind of a miserable time in my life. Again, not because the company wasn't great. The company's outstanding, you know, at least it was back then. I can say nothing bad about it, but I was irritated at myself. And now if I hadn't done it, I wouldn't be able to be fortunate to be here and get to do all I do. So every time you make a decision, whether it's good or it's bad, I've learned to realize that there's probably something greater coming out of this thing, and who knows what it's going to be. If you always knew what was coming, life would be boring. You know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's talk about sales, sales and sales training and some of the things that you teach people. Cause I work with a lot of salespeople as an owner of a marketing agency, a sales and marketing agency. We're a little bit different than your typical agency in that we deliver sales development as a service for some of our clients,
right.
In addition to traditional digital marketing and strategy. And so I have the great opportunity to interface with a lot of salespeople, and some good, some not so good. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the biggest mistake that you see salespeople make on just a day in and day out, even the good ones? What's the one or two things that you're like, if I could just get salespeople to stop doing this one thing, I think I can make a big difference in all of their performance.
Yeah, I think, there's probably, it's hard to do one, right?
Sure. Maybe give me a couple. I mean, what comes to mind?
Yeah. Well, okay. So one of the things that comes to mind, especially when salespeople start, is the biggest mistake they make is they do not rip the Band-Aid off. And what I mean by that is when it comes to doing all the hard behavior you have to do to get to prospect, right? Everybody hates prospecting. You hate calling people or trying to, get to people that you don't know. You're always worried about getting rejected. And so you take your time. And if you think about it visually, a Band-Aid, I have a little bit of hair on my arms, right? So if I put a big Band-Aid or a piece of tape, let's just say I put a piece of duct tape on my arm, I can remove this duct tape slowly, because I'm worried about it hurting and not pulling all my hair off, or I can just rip it off, right? And granted, I might rip some hair on my arm and it may hurt really bad, but it's just for a second. I think one of the biggest mistakes they may make is they don't rip the Band-Aid off or the tape off fast and do everything they have to do to start to succeed quick. They kind of take their time on it. Okay, well, I'll prospect a little bit today. I'll prospect a little bit tomorrow. And then I'll do all kinds of other stuff that occupy my time, what we call creative avoidance. Instead of let's just do the hard stuff now, get it out of the way. And it really includes prospecting. And so that's the key piece. I see a lot of salespeople fail because they just fail to prospect. I don't care if you don't even have a good plan of who you're prospecting. You may not be as efficient or effective at it, but if you're doing enough behavior, you're going to be successful. I promise you. You may be tired, but you're going to be successful. I've seen it. It happened to me in the 90s. I wasn't good at selling. I was scared to death of not prospecting. So I prospected a lot. And I was always worried about that. And so I succeeded because of that. So that's the first thing. Number two is, think that salespeople, many of them, worry way too much about what people think of them. Worry about way too much about whether people like them or not. And they try to create what we call relationships, but they don't even know what that word means. And they don't think about how can I create value for that other person by asking them the right questions, by helping them self-discover things. How can I figure out a way to see if there's some challenges they have that I might have solutions for? And if I don't have solutions for it, that's fine. Let's just call the day. We'll still, we can part as friends. We're not really intimate friends by any means, but a lot of salespeople spend an inordinate amount of time trying to be friends with people, trying to avoid ever getting a no, trying to not asking tough questions. And then later on down the line, they're wasting their time. They're wasting the person's time. They're not truthful with each other. It could have been a no, they would never knew. I think that if they can stop worrying about getting people to like them and worry about maybe getting respect, we call it equal business stature, then they'll be better at asking the questions, figure out how to add value to people's lives, and they'll be much more successful. I think they just kind of missed the beat. I've never been a prospect, never is a strong word. Rarely do you meet prospects whose number one goal when they meet you is to have a new friend. That's usually not their goal, right? And so, why make it our goal? And so those are two big pieces. If I could get people to prospect and to get out of their own head in terms of trying to be too much friends and trying to avoid conflict, because they make it about themselves, right? They need to stop making it about themselves and think about the other person. So those are two big pieces right there.
No, I love those. So that first one about prospecting, let's talk about that for a moment. Okay. So is there a right amount to prospect? Is there a rule of thumb that you like to give people, or is it really dependent on the solution, the complexity, the market?
Wouldn't it be easy if there was a silver bullet and a rule of thumb?
Yeah.
I think that the way you think about this is you look at what you're selling. So if you're selling a service, or if you're selling a product, you know who your ideal, target client is. Sometimes people have a big enterprise sale, right, where they have many, many decision makers. Some people have one decision maker. But you look at your ideal client and your ideal titles, if you will, you think about not just that stuff, but you think about also as my goals, how much money do I need to make? And then how much do I need to sell to make that kind of money? And the amount you need to sell needs to be above what the corporation wants you to sell. So if the company wants you to sell $1 million and you say, well, I only need to sell 800 to make my goals, that doesn't align. So you have to at least be at that $1 million or above. So you think about, well, how much do I need to sell to make the money I want to make, provided you have some sort of compensation that's variable? And then you start to think about, I know I need to go after these type of people. How do I get in front of them? What are some of my activities? And we call it a cookbook in Sandler. And then I because I might have to have, let's say I have to have three meetings a week. And then from those three meetings, I generally will get, one proposal, and I generally will close, a third of those proposals. And you start to kind of look at, all right, what's an average deal worth? These are really scientific calculations, but it all stems from, what are my goals? Make sure they align with the company goals. Then who would I need to go after? How do I do that? And then you make it almost like a financial planner would say, you diversify your activities, right? And so some of it might be making cold calls. Some of it might be sending emails. Some of it might be virtual networking events or regular networking when face-to-face comes back. Some of it may be we do a lot of public speaking. There's so many different activities, but what you have to do is you have to figure out a mix of activities, start doing it, hold yourself accountable to do it, and then along the way, figure out what works. What worked 17 years ago for us is not the same today. But people analyze this so much. There is a formula, and you can put it down on paper. But like with any good plan, it never goes perfect, right? But and so there's I wouldn't say people go, okay, if you just make 100 cold calls a day, you're going to be successful. Well, I think that's complete black and white crap. That's not necessarily true.
Right.
That may not work as well in your industry. It doesn't mean you shouldn't make some cold calls, but there's probably a mix of stuff that works well here. And so I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but that's kind of the way I think about it.
I think you're right. I think backing into the numbers is always the first step in the process is just use your conversion metrics and come up with, I don't need 100 meetings a month. I need 12 meetings a month, 12 good meetings. And if they're the right meetings, then I know the rest of my metrics, my conversion rates from a meeting to proposal to deal, deal to revenue. I can do the math, like you said. It's interesting though, whenever you were talking about, and it might've just been, you might not have been intentional, but maybe it was. And so I want to ask you about it. You talked about, hey, it might be cold calling, it might be sending some emails, all these different channels, be speaking engagements or networking events. You didn't say anything about social media. So where are you at on social selling as a prospecting strategy right now?
I like social selling as a not an alternative, but as an addition to what you're doing. So for example, LinkedIn. I mean, sending an in-mail message through LinkedIn is social selling. But sometimes people look at social selling as I post a lot of stuff on LinkedIn or Facebook or Instagram or whatever you're using, right? And then I just wait for people to call me. That I do not agree with. I agree that you should put that stuff out there, 100%. But if you're waiting, that's called passive prospecting. It's like waiting for someone to call you. It's waiting for your check, right? It's waiting for, if the government gives you a check every month, you're waiting for your check. I don't believe in that. That's the way that you should incorporate prospecting. So I do believe in social selling, but not as a, I'm just going to passively put all the stuff out there and hope that they come. Because I think that's what's been, the world, especially if you're in digital marketing, and no offense if you do digital marketing, but sometimes some people who digital marketing, they're selling sort of value prop is, look, I will put all this out there for you and they will come. I've hardly seen it happen that well. Now there are people, I have a friend of mine who owns a moving company. She does all her leads are online. She spends, and she'll tell you, a massive amount of money for the leads that she gets. A massive amount of money. And so if you have a massive amount of money, I bet you it could work. Most people don't have a massive amount of money to do that. And so I think it's an in addition, not as a substitute.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the key here, I think the big takeaway should be for people, listening today or thinking, how do I get better at building a sales pipeline, should be diversify your activities. Don't just pick one channel. Pursue multiple channels. And I think from a social selling standpoint, just posting your thoughts is going to be largely ineffective. Yes. The most effective way I found and what I've learned on social is to engage in a conversation that already exists. To the extent you can create the conversation, that's even better, but it's not even necessary. In some cases, it might not even be most advantageous. If you find a conversation that's already going on, and then you insert a thoughtful response that causes people to go, well, now that's interesting. Who is this person?
Right.
That's where you can get some meaningful engagement from a social selling standpoint.
I agree with you on that, Mike, but have you ever seen it where people engage, they go in there, they insert themselves in a conversation and they do a meaningful thought and then they just completely go into salesperson mode, negated all the goodwill you just put in that conversation.
Right.
And you go into the, okay. So someone goes, oh, that was a really good thought. And you go, oh, I can help you. Call me up. And it's like, you don't know if you can help them yet, but you put a nice meaningful thought in there. And so instead of subtly, you know, saying, hey, would it make sense for us to have a short little conversation if you're interested in this? We go into the, well, here's what I do and here's what I can help you with. And I see that all the time. And I'm like, you were so good till then, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah. It's just, you know, it's a human interaction and people respond. People don't respond to being told things. And it's the same thing if I was to, you know, meet a romantic interest, you know, that I might pursue that person. You know, the first thing I wouldn't talk about is myself. The most powerful way to engage is to ask them about themselves. Right.
Right.
Start asking questions. Once you get a conversation, you don't say, that's really interesting. Now let me tell you all about myself. It's like, then it's over. You've ruined it.
Agreed. And yeah, you're the expert on the marketing side of this. I mean, to the extent I'm not anywhere as near as much of the expert on that stuff. I mean, rely on guys like you to really help, who understand the social side of selling way more than I do. I learn more and more, but I'm not engaged in it every single day. You just said an interesting thing. What'd you say? You know, it's like your parent, you know, it's like you don't like to be told what to do. I was thinking when I was a kid, I didn't like it when my parents told me what to do. I did it because I was forced to. I don't like it now. Right. I don't like it now. And so, you know, when people try to tell you what to do, it sort of engages part of you inside that doesn't want to be told what to do. It almost reminds you of your parents. And, you know, sometimes we either one, push back, maybe we do it vocally, or number two is we just, you know, avoid the conversation altogether. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So. We don't use the word. In fact, I take that word out of our vocabulary altogether. Whenever I'm working with our sales development teams, we never tell. I'd like to send something so we could tell you about. We never tell you about. We want to share with you. It's just we want to share with you. It's a little thing, but people don't want to be talked to like that, right? I would never invite someone into my office to tell me anything. No, thank you.
I love share. I love that word. It's a great word, right? It's a nuance, but the word share is something that we talk about too. But I love that. Because it's like sharing is something that is nice and easy, right? I'm sharing with you. I'm not trying to tell you to do something. I'm sharing with you. And I might be even sharing with you something that other people have done, not even something I think you should do yet, right? Yeah. But I'm sharing with other people have done, and it may not make any sense for you. I'm sharing, you know, what other problems that other people have had, and sharing with what I've done to help them. Again, no assumptions about you. I mean, it's great language. I love it.
Yeah. So it's something I'm always fascinated. I bet you have an interesting perspective on. So, you know, there's this old, is it an axiom? I think that's the right word. That the best players don't always make the best coaches, and vice versa. What's your take on organizations that pick their best players and make them the leader of the team? You know, what are your thoughts on that? I'll sleep there.
All right. So I don't, again, not doing black and white. Generally, it's a mistake.
Yeah.
And I don't have the statistics. I have the experience to show that every time someone has done, I say most times that people have done that, it tends to be a mistake because first, the person who's awesome at selling, who loves to hunt, who loves that kind of thrill, doesn't always love being a great sales manager, right? A sales manager or sales leader, it takes a different style of person many times, right? It's a person who is, who has to be really good at stepping back and not being the person who's in the spotlight anymore, right? It has to be a person who is, when you go into a sales call, lets the other person fail. It has to be a person who generally, again, great salespeople love to be in the spotlight. They like to be number one. They like to be recognized for that. When you're a sales leader, that's the last thing you need to be. It's all about your team. It's not about you anymore. And so we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but I think that and you look at the companies, you say, why did you do that? Well, I figured if he was really, really good at sales, he must be a great sales leader. Okay. By the way, a lot of sales leaders, especially when they first come up, make less money than they did as a salesperson. So that's not always a good thing too. I think it seems natural to think that way. If they're great at one thing, they must be great at another. But a lot of times it's because the owner or the president or the, you know, VP, if they're hiring, putting a sales manager in, hasn't really thought through the role and thought about what's important for this role. What do they have to do to be successful in this role? And if I think about that and I really write that out and think, what is the job functions? What are the skills and experience and, you know, past results and cognitive and habits? If I really wrote that out and kind of almost created this matrix of a perfect ideal candidate, I might look at my number one salesperson and say, that person's not even close to this, nor do I even want to try to get them to this, right? And so I think that a lot of times we don't think through what that job role needs to look like. We just naturally think if they're good at this, they'll be good at this and they'll want this, right? And so again, this is a long conversation, but that's my quick summary.
I think you're right. I've seen it be, I've seen it really backfire, and just financially, what you've done is taking your A player out of the rotation. You had your guy hit and clean up. Sorry to use the baseball metaphor, but yep. You know, you had your cleanup hitter and you just now put him on the bench. And yes, you know, there's his insight or her insight into the process that each of the individuals are using is certainly valuable, but they often don't possess the coaching skills. We know a sales leader is 90% coach. Maybe that's
No, I think it's 90% coaching. It's not normally, yeah. But it should be.
It should be. If more sales leaders spent more time coaching and less time managing up, they'd have less to talk about managing up. They manage up because they're not being effective, right? If they just got the results by coaching, then no one would ever, you know, talk to them again. They could just go do their job. But, you know, we have to manage up when we're underachieving. We manage up when we're underachieving, not when we're overachieving.
I agree with that. But, you know, a great salesperson could be a mentor more so than a manager, right?
So. Yeah, we see that a lot now. People are in sophisticated sales organizations that really put an emphasis on this, of pairing salespeople and creating structure around mentoring. So someone has someone to go. A junior guy might have someone to go to and ask her questions about how she's being effective and how she's leading and, you know, the things that, how she organizes her day or how she handles a tough conversation.
Can I make one caveat about that? I love that model. As long as the great salesperson, as long as they have been following a sales process and they've been doing things the right way, versus just being a rebel and doing things their own way, because you might be trying to put a playbook together, put a process in place, you know, you bring a brand new person on, you're saying, this is how we're going to go sell. Here's our process. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to say, here's how you're going to prospect. Boom, 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 right? You're trying to really onboard them and get them indoctrinated into the culture. Sometimes if you give them to the number one salesperson who has not been following all that, but it's been around for a long time, they sort of almost visually put their arm around them and say, I know what Mike's telling you to do. Here's what you really need to do. And that can backfire the whole thing. So I love the mentor, as long as it's the person who is going to say, here's why you should follow the processes and here's how they help me, right?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I think you're absolutely right, because that can undermine the entire process, especially if you're trying to create change in an organization and you want to have less reliance on the personality of the individual and more on a structured, repeatable process that can be scaled and grow.
Correct.
Here's another sort of common, I think misconception. What's your take on it? That I love talking to sales guys about is, especially in this comes up a lot in organizations where there's not a sales culture. Maybe it's a startup or an early stage company where you've got a technical founder who's doesn't really know the sales world. They sell because they're passionate about what they do and they've got tremendous amount of expertise, but they don't really follow a process because they don't know what a process might look like. And So when you talk to them, whenever they're initially wanting to start building a sales organization, it's really funny how consistently the stereotype that they think of when they think they need to get a salesperson, that they almost always describe the same guy or gal, the same set of skills, the same personality. And I'm interested in your sort of perspective on how much does personality have to do with this? Is a successful salesperson have to be an extrovert? Can they be an introvert? Can an introvert outsell an extrovert? Is there some advantage to being maybe a little bit more conscientious and thoughtful and maybe subdued in their approach, or do you think that it really takes someone who can come in and really light people up and bring an energy into a situation to be effective?
Yeah. Well, look, it depends on how you describe personality. I guess one of the ways you can describe personalities is using like a DISC scale. I mean, you could use DISC or Myers-Briggs, or you can use all kinds of personality scales out there. But DISC is probably one of the simple ones, right? And so we have four styles there, but every one of the styles can sell. Every one of them can sell. Each one of them has their own weaknesses that make it, that sort of roadblock them. If you just said, Troy, why do so many extroverts, because that's who they're describing, right? Someone who can make friends with anybody, someone who can light up a room. But why do so many of those people get sales jobs, and why do so many of those people fail? The reason why most of those people get sales jobs is because they blow you away in the interview, right? They make you feel so good and, I just love them and such a great conversation. And so you think that it was a great conversation because they said all the right things, they made you feel good. And so you think they must be able to sell to anybody. But did they really, in the interview, you kind of think about this, did they talk, maybe they talk a lot and they were really bubbly, or did you talk, was it really a sales call that you were seeing them in, or was it an interview that was set up in a way that made it where they thrived? But also number two is, sometimes when we want to hire a salesperson, we're so motivated to hire a salesperson that we sometimes don't even see how that person in front of us is talking the whole time. Obviously they're real friendly and everything like that. And we just go, oh my God, they got to be awesome. And so we sort of kind of miss the boat because we're so motivated. I an extroverted person is not a bad thing. It's just that they a lot of times don't know how to shut up. And so there's a rule in Sandler that say it's called 70-30. I mean, you should talk 30 and listen 70. And sometimes it's hard to do. But if you take an introverted person, a lot of times, depending upon where they are on the introversion scale, they could be a lot better too, because they're more listeners, they're more thoughtful, sometimes they're more empathetic. They tend to ask, good questions, but sometimes they're such a perfectionist that they overanalyze things and they won't even do things. Sometimes there's an introverted type person that hates conflict. And so maybe they need to ask a real tough question and they avoid it. And so, every one of the personalities in here, if you look at a very direct person who's sort of extroverted, maybe doesn't talk as much, sometimes they bulldoze over people. They look too aggressive, right? And so which one works the best? All of them can sell. I would tell you that many of the people we think are the perfect salespeople aren't, because they just don't stop talking long enough. And also, some of the times, those people who are super extroverted have a very high need for approval. They do care tremendously about being liked. And so they tend to avoid going for no. They tend to have cycles that last forever. They don't tend to always get to the right decision makers. They tend to think a proposal is qualified when it really isn't, or a deal is qualified when it really isn't. So again, we go all around the map of every one of them.
Right.
But I tell you, most salespeople are hired because they make you feel good in an interview. It's nothing more than that. And we're so motivated to want to hire somebody, we overlook the most obvious things in front of us. And so that's why we do assessments. And that's why we help our clients. We interview a lot of times people for our clients, because I'm not emotionally invested in their person. Now, if I have somebody come here, I have to have somebody else help me interview, because I'm emotionally invested in my person. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. I love that you kind of broke that down, that all personality types can sell, because that's, I absolutely believe that. And I don't think that there is necessarily a winning recipe personality wise. I think there are some attributes. It's all about strengths and weaknesses. Everyone's got something that they can bring unique to the table. And then they've got something that's going to, that they'll have to overcome as a challenge. That's just a natural challenge for them.
Yes.
I think at the end of the day, if you have a spirit of wanting to help and you are comfortable asking difficult questions, I think you can, and you're willing to work hard, those three things will usually, regardless of the personality, those three things will probably carry the day and help you be successful. I want to talk about sales managers for a moment here in the last couple minutes. So we talked a little bit about hiring and some of the mistakes that a sales manager might make. They get caught up in the personality or the energy of a moment and maybe miss whether or not they actually have the skills or experience to perform.
Right.
So now you've got a guy on your team who's not performing, right? My guess is a lot of these people find their way to you at times. What would you say to a sales manager who's frustrated because maybe he's got a small sales team and he's invested a lot in a person and they just are not performing and he doesn't quite know what the issue is or what to do about it? Like, what kind of advice would you give a guy in that situation?
Well, I'd say you're not alone. First, right? There's a lot of sales managers and owners and such that have sales teams that are not performing to the expectation that they hoped. But I think you have to start to kind of digest a little bit. I mean, and figure that out. It's almost like doing some root cause stuff. I mean, are they not performing because you haven't maybe, given them the skills necessary? You think you're hiring these thoroughbreds, right? Oh, I hired this person. They have 10 years of sales experience, so they must perform. Well, I mean, that may or may not be true. If they've never been trained before, they were really successful at their other companies, but why? Was it because they had account management? Now you're putting them into hunting? I mean, really? So first and foremost, did I give them the skills? Number two, do I have a process they're supposed to follow? That's been in the, if I have a sales process they're supposed to follow, if I don't, I need to put one in place because it's not really fair for them too. Because you can't really measure what's really working or not working unless you have a process you're supposed to follow. If you have a manufacturing business, they have ISO for a reason. It's not to make things perfect. It's to understand when things go wrong, what went wrong, right? And to try to be more consistent. So I think you have to have that process. I think you, then if you have a process and then they are trained and they're not doing it, then you have to understand why are they not doing it? What's going on? I mean, what might be going on in their heads? And so sometimes that requires assessing your team if you've never assessed them before, to figure out what are some of the behavioral attributes that might be keeping them from performing, assuming the fact that you've trained them, assuming that you've got a process they should be following, assuming that they have an expectation they should follow the process. Then it's like, well, let's do some real coaching to figure out why they're not doing it. I think you also have to say, have I really coached them? Have I really sat down with them? Have I really role played with them? Have I really ridden along with them? Have I really done them justice? Because a lot of times we just go, oh, well, they should know what they're doing. So, I mean, you could just go down the list of almost like root cause. But I wouldn't just go fire all of them. If they're toxic,
right,
that's a values thing, right? We should not have them on our team. And so I kind of go down that list of stuff to say, well, what is there? Are you coaching? Do you have a process? Do you, if you don't have a process, if you're not coaching, if you're not riding along with them, do you know why they're not doing it and so on, right? And so, that's kind of the path I would take there and realize that most owners we talk to, I've hardly ever met an owner or a manager who doesn't have some amount of other people that are underperforming. It's that eight. That's why there's an 80-20 rule, right? that 80% of the business is being brought in by like one or two of your people.
Right. And it maybe even, you know, more descriptive, you know, there's a bell curve, and there's usually going to be in an organization. You're going to have a couple superstars. You're going to have a couple guys that are habitual, you know, underperformers. And then if you can just get as many people as you can into that range of acceptable performance, you know, making quota, then, mm-hmm. you know, you can win. And then you're just constantly trying to either, you know, bring the skills up of your underperformers or replacing them with people that are a better fit for the organization.
I will say one thing that's really important to ask yourself if you're an owner or a manager.
Yeah.
If you say, I've got, let's just say A, B, and C players, easy way to degrade them. If you say, look, I've got a bunch of B minus, if you're being transparent and real, right? Some people like to say all my people are A's, which we know that's not true, right?
Right.
But if we say, look, I've got a bunch of B minus or C plus players in my group, you have to ask yourself a tough question as a manager or an owner. Did I make them that way or did I hire them that way? Right. Because if I hired them that way, that's a problem. If I made them that way, that's a bigger problem. Right. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, look, Troy, it's been a fascinating conversation. I love talking about this stuff. I know it's something that's obviously you've dedicated the last 17 years of your life to having these conversations and working with sales organizations to help them get better. What's the best way for someone to reach you if they want to continue the conversation and learn more about you and your team at Sandler to help them achieve the goals that they have for their sales teams?
Probably the easiest ways is you can obviously visit our website, which is obviously the three W's, but it's .iss, which stands for the legal name of our company is called Impassioned Sales Solutions, and that really came from just how much I feel wholehearted about what I do. So I named the company Impassioned Sales Solutions, but so it's www.iss.sandler.com. So that's okay. One way. And then they can also reach me via email. So it's my first initial last name, tlmore@sandler.com. Probably the two easiest ways to do it. And if they want to have a conversation.
That's awesome. Well, thanks, Troy. Thanks for sharing your insight today. And we'll certainly include your contact information and links to your website in our show notes. That'll be posted on our website at prosalesconnection.com/podcast. And you'll be able to find the video and audio recording there and along with Troy's contact information. So that'll be available for everyone. And look, before I wrap up, I just want to take a minute and thank everyone who's been following this podcast and listening in on a weekly basis. I'm really grateful for everyone's following along and the positive feedback that I'm getting from folks and that you're enjoying these conversations. So I really am grateful for that. And I will continue to find more interesting and thought leaders like Troy to bring on the show and talk about some of these topics around what we call the big three of B2B leadership of personal growth and organizational growth and market growth. Those are the three things that really drive us and as the types of conversations that we want to get in with experts. So thanks so much for your participation and thanks for listening. And remember to check us out on iTunes and leave a 5-star review if you like what we're doing. It's super helpful to help people find us easier so we can get our message and our content out to more and more people. And look, B2B leaders grow companies faster when they follow and focus on the big three of B2B leadership. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
Pro Sales Connection is a sales and marketing firm that has been helping B2B companies grow faster since 2009. Learn more about our proprietary fastest path to revenue process for B2B companies. Experiencing the possibilities begins with a short 15-minute call. Schedule yours at www.prosalesconnection.com and click Get Started.